Well, good evening, everyone. And thank you very much for turning out, in spite of the horrible weather. It's good to see so many people here for the book launch, for the book that we have in front of us. My name is Professor David Stephenson. I'm head of the International History Department. I'll be saying a few words to introduce the session tonight. And then our author, Nigel Ashton, will be speaking about his new book. And Professor Arne Westad from Ideas will be making some comments, and then we'll be opening the whole session up for question and answer. And we hope you'll have lots of questions and answers. Well, you'll have lots of questions, and Nigel will have lots of answers.
Maybe some political answers.
Maybe you have some questions he can't answer, but that's the kind of programme for tonight. So, first thing, a few words of introduction about Nigel and the book. Nigel, I think, was one of the original Gang of Four that put the proposal together that led to the Cold War Studies Centre, out of which Ideas grew, and he's also been a member of the International History Department since 1998, which is when I first met him, and I think for most of the decade that he spent in the department, he's been working on this book, which began, I think, in 1999.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing before you is the fruit of nearly 10 years of very hard work. And Nigel, this is Nigel's third major book. His first one was on Eisenhower, Macmillan and the Problem of NASA, which came out in 1996, looking at Anglo-American diplomacy in the Middle East in the late 1950s. The second one was Kennedy, Macmillan and the Cold War, The Irony of Interdependence, which again had material on the Middle East in it, and was switching more to the Anglo-American relationship more globally. This book, on the biography of King Hussein of Jordan, moves, I think, very considerable measure beyond both of those first two books. And if you're looking for reasons why you should read and hopefully buy this book, there are three major things that seem to me important. The first one is the scope and ambition of the book. The second thing is the information in the book. And the third thing is the interpretation. So if I can just say a few things under each of those headings. The first thing is the scope and the ambition. And what Nigel has done is to provide a political life, of course, of King Hussein. And in order to do that, he's had, in effect, to rewrite the international history of the Middle East for four decades, from the 1950s to the 1990s. And maybe, in a way, precisely because Jordan was, because of Jordan's geographical location, in the centre of all the turbulent developments during that period, but also, in a way, because of its weakness, because of its lack of power within the equation, it was important to establish the context, and that meant becoming familiar with a great mass of historiography and having things to say about the crises that run through from the dismissal of Fuad Pasha in the 1950s through to the sort of classic height of the Arab-Israeli conflict in 67, 70, 73, then on to the Gulf conflicts, strange relationship between Hussein and King Hussein and Saddam in the 1980s and 1990s. And all of that's there, four decades of upheaval and conflict. And what he's done, I think, is to provide an international history that looks at the diplomacy of this period, but also provides great detail and new information about the intelligence. And that's one of the things that most struck me reading the book, and I think will also be evident to anyone else who looks at it, about the role of MI6 and CIA, and floods of new light that's been made available on those topics. So the scope and ambition is the first thing that's important. The second thing is I simply found that this was a very remarkable effort of research. In other words, the sheer quantity of previously unfamiliar new information that's available in the book on all of the crises covered within the time span that fall within its pages. Now, a lot of this I remember living through at the time, reading the papers fairly, I think, closely through the crises of the 1970s and 1980s. And a lot of it was passed by our experience, I think, as ordinary newspaper readers, but also as passed by the previous sources, accounts that have been written of this period. So a lot of this is just simply very new, and it's new because of the effort of source work that's gone into it. In particular, it's based on major archival research in Britain, in the United States, and, of course, in Jordan. And that's perhaps the key thing, the triangulation of Western and Arab accounts of the conflict. So I think this has gone through, like so much of the history of the Cold War period, through successive logical strata almost, based on the information that was available at the time. So early accounts of the Middle East had to use published sources. Later on, British and American archival sources became available. And somewhat later still, Israeli sources became available. So, of course, a lot of the history of 1956 and 1967 has come to be rewritten from the Israeli vantage point. What's new about this, I think, is a huge quantity of high-level sources coming out from an Arab state. And because of Jordan's perspective, what's covered here is not just King Hussein's own role, but also the interaction between him and other leading Arab players, such as Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. So in a sense, this sheds insight onto the diplomacy of the Arab states as a whole, which previously, I think, was a great blank area for speculation in all of the accounts of the Middle East during the Cold War period. So if the first thing is the scope and ambition of this, the second thing is the question of the source material and the information that's in the book, which I think will be very illuminating to anyone who thought that they knew about this period. The third thing is the interpretation. And all I want to say about that is this is a biography. And it's important for what it says about Hussein the man and the political actor. And Hussein as a Hashemite and as an Arab nationalist. And on reading the book, a lot of things became clearer to me that had previously been puzzling. For example, the line that King Hussein took, particularly notoriously in the Gulf conflict of 1990 to 91, and his ties with Saddam Hussein, became more apparent, more explicable, once I'd looked at the previous evolution of his career and his perspective in the book here. And the other thing that's very important is the relationship with Israel, and in particular Nigel's questioning of the concept of a spoken or unspoken strategic partnership between Jordan and Israel. I found it's much more complicated than that in the presentation that we have here. There was also an undercurrent of rivalry and a perception of threat always on the Jordanian side running through. I think that's one of the things that struck me. There are many other important, rich points of interpretation that could be brought out here, but I think it's much better if that comes from Nigel himself, so I'll hand over to him now.
Well, thanks for that kind introduction, David. I just want to start by conjuring up for you three ways in which I've thought about King Hussein while I've been writing this book. The first King Hussein is probably familiar to everybody in the room, and that's King Hussein the realist. King Hussein, who came to the throne at the age of 17, came to the throne of a weak, resource-poor country, ringed round by rivals and enemies. The King Hussein who had to develop an astute sense of the likely actions and motives of other regional players simply to survive. I think for a lot of commentators, and indeed for the reviewer of my book in the New York Times as well, this is King Hussein's story. King Hussein was the ultimate Arab realist, and he survived by playing people off against each other and by having a pretty astute sense of what everyone was up to. But I see a second King Hussein there as well, and that's King Hussein the idealist. King Hussein, the man who thought he had a mission to help bring about Arab unity and independence. King Hussein, the man who also thought he had a mission to help resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict, who thought he was uniquely placed to help resolve that conflict. King Hussein, who thought about that conflict on a sort of wide historical canvas. Now, for King Hussein, the Arab-Israeli conflict as it manifested itself in the second half of the 20th century was a sort of transient historical phenomenon, a passing phase, and because he thought on this broader canvas, he believed that he was uniquely well-placed to help bring about an end to this conflict. But I've also always had to think about another King Hussein, and this is where I've had to learn quite a bit in terms of writing biography. This is King Hussein, the emotional, irrational, intuitive, impulsive human being. The King Hussein who doesn't fit neatly into the boxes of realist or idealist, who sometimes acts for completely other motives. And one story I like that for me always sums this up is something that happened in the September 1970 crisis in Jordan. Some of you will be familiar with the background to this. The Hashemite regime was threatened by the Palestinian guerrilla groups who'd established themselves in Jordan. And finally, after a lot of delay, King Hussein finally came to the conclusion that he was going to have to move against these groups. And he fixed the date to move against them as being the 16th of September, 1970. But at the very last minute, the wife of his brother, Prince Mohammed, her name's Princess Firyal, got in touch with him and gave him some disturbing news. She told him that she'd been to visit her fortune teller in London. And the fortune teller told her that the 16th of September would be a very bad day for the Hashemites. So at the last minute, and there's a big gap in the Western records here, everyone's trying to work out why hasn't it come today. The MI6 man and the CIA station chief have both been told it's coming 16th of September. And at the last minute, it doesn't. It goes back to the 17th. I think for the first time, we now know why. It's the fortune teller. I've never been able to track the fortune teller down, incidentally. I did try once, but she may well have passed on already. So I had to think about all of these King Husseins when I was writing the book. But let me just underline one point, and I think David's already brought this out very well. If you were going to get access to the papers of any Arab head of state in the second half of the 20th century, I would argue King Hussein is the man you want. Not just because he was around longer than almost anyone else, I mean, that's one obvious reason, but crucially, he talked to everyone. He had channels to everyone. And in a region that's not particularly known for its dialogue, King Hussein was someone who kept the channels open all round. I think that's the thing that makes his files unique in the region. Right. All very well to have access to new sources. What's actually new? What's new that came out of these sources? Let me just briefly run through a few things that I think are worth highlighting. I'll talk briefly about the Arab-Israeli wars. I'll talk about the covert peace process, the overt peace process, his relations with Saddam, and then finally the peace with Israel. I'll do so briefly because we've garnered a chance to talk. The 1967 war, I'm making actually quite a startling claim in the book about the 1967 war. I'm claiming that King Hussein was told in advance that when the Israeli attack was coming, and he was also, let me just take it one step further than I did in the book for the benefit of those here, he was also told that it was expected the Arabs would lose within a week. And he was told that the day before, I'd be more specific than I am in the book, he was told that the day before the Israeli attack came. Even more remarkable is that he passed this warning on in two communications to Nasser. So this information got to the Egyptian president Nasser the day before the war broke out. Now, Nasser didn't react. We don't know why. I speculate in the book it's because of the dysfunctional state of the Egyptian leadership. Nasser isn't really in control of his own army. Or possibly because of lack of trust in his relations with Hussein. 1973... the 1973 war, I've been able to take this much further, I think, than anyone has up to now. It's been known for a long time that King Hussein went to visit Golda Meir, the Israeli Prime Minister, on the 25th of September 1973, and that he issued a warning in this meeting about the likely outbreak of war. What I've been able to do in the book is track back and show where he got the information from. I've named the Jordanian handler of the Syrian agent. I could name the Syrian agent which he got it from, but I'm obviously not going to do that for fairly obvious reasons. But also, crucially, just to tantalise you with something else, King Hussein got a date for the attack, roughly a fortnight in advance of when it happened. And that date was the 5th of October, not the 6th of October. Now, here we should be scratching our heads because, come on, this is the Yom Kippur War. Yom Kippur is 6th of October. Why would they be going to attack a day before? In the book, I speculate as to various reasons why that's the case, but I just underline this is very well-founded and credible information that the original plan was to go one day earlier. I can maybe say a bit more about that later. The covert contacts, briefly. Again, long been known that King Hussein, across the decades, had covert contacts with a succession of Israeli representatives. What I've been able to do is to add to this story in a couple of important ways. I've highlighted a couple of new channels, one of which I think is highly significant. This is the channel from King Hussein to Moshe Dayan, the former Israeli Chief of Staff and Defense Minister. And this channel is was brokered by James Jesus Angleton of the CIA, someone who knew both of these men very well. This channel nearly came dramatically into the open after the 1967 war. Moshe Dayan got in touch with Angleton. He told him that he was concerned that Israel might be intending to annex the West Bank, and if this happened, the whole conflict would be frozen. There would be no way out. So Dayan, through Angleton, wanted to arrange a meeting with King Hussein. And that meeting was scheduled to take place in Geneva at the end of July 1967. In fact, it never happened, and I've explained why in the book. But I think it's a very significant channel between the King and Moshe Dayan. The other one and here I can't resist quoting a letter for you, is to George Brown. George Brown, the former British Foreign Secretary and Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, seems to have played the role of covert intermediary between King Hussein and Israeli representatives across an extended period of time. And I only happened upon this because of a marvellous letter from Brown that I found in King Hussein's papers. Let me just quote it to you. Brown had just been on a trip to Israel at the beginning of 1970, and he wrote to King Hussein right afterwards in these terms. "I think I should let you know that I'm still being used as a postbox. Letters these days are bad. Too many people read them. I wonder whether I could meet you or anybody you would nominate in any place to have a talk about the situation as I now think it to be." Well, this letter reminded me nothing more than the old instructions about how you should go about wiring up a British plug, which is George Brown is a live wire. I think this pretty much sums up George Brown's role in all of this. Brown was well connected on both sides, and I think for an extended period, certainly dating back to the 1967 war, he was a covert channel who passed messages between the two sides. Well, briefly on the overt peace process, I think a fascinating episode in the King's files, the Camp David's agreement between Egypt and Israel. What I've been able to do there by looking at his correspondence with not just President Carter, but also Anwar Sadat, also Yasser Arafat, is to show the way in which Camp David faced King Hussein with awkward choices and ultimately divided the Arab world. And again, I think this is unique and unusual to be able to do it in the sort of round like this, rather than just all from American records, and maybe one or two memoir accounts from Arab or other participants. For the first time, this is proper documentation coming out from a key player. Well, next, and I think perhaps even more interesting, the King and Saddam Hussein. This is a relationship that's puzzled people, I think, deeply. They can't quite understand how King Hussein, this moderate, pro-Western, friendly Arab leader, could have had this close personal and political relationship with the Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein across two decades. Well, I look into this in depth in the book. I quote, again, a marvellous handwritten letter from Saddam, which he sent in 1986, which I would describe as being the closest one can come to a love letter from a despot. Saddam eulogized the agreement and harmony between us, which is built on the foundations of commitment and mutual trust and cooperation and keenness on the higher interests of the nation. And of course it was the Iran-Iraq war which raged between 1980 and 1988, which provided the essential backdrop to the flowering of this personal relationship between the two men. But what's also interesting in King Hussein's files is the way in which I've been able to detail how he acted as an intermediary between Iraq and the United States in this period, passing on battlefield intelligence to the Iraqis, acting as a sort of interpreter, if you like, of Saddam Hussein to the Americans. And also, crucially, the way he was double-crossed in 1986. Briefly, the Americans had fed Iraq what turned out to be false battlefield intelligence, which resulted in a major defeat, their biggest defeat in the last 6 years of the war. King Hussein tried to persuade Saddam this was all a mistake, and then lo and behold, within months, the Iran-Contra scandal broke, and his position was completely undercut at that point. Again, worth quoting just briefly from one letter he sent to President Reagan on this. This is King Hussein after Iran-Contra. He says this: "I had, out of conviction, done much to remove Iraqi suspicions that the United States government deliberately misled the Iraqi military when the Iranians attacked Al-Faw. Will not the Iraqis now feel that they were misled, not only by the United States, but also by anyone who tries to explain, justify, or defend American actions?" Well, I think understanding this role during the Iran-Iraq War, as David has commented already, is a crucial part of understanding the stance that King Hussein took in the next major regional crisis, which was the Gulf Crisis of 1990 to 1991. I think you can put a strong case that actually the Gulf Crisis, not the 1967 war, is King Hussein's biggest error in the whole of his reign. But it's not that he's insincere in terms of his position, not that he's insincere in trying to mediate this crisis. It's that he misjudges the positions of Iraq and the United States. He believes there's middle ground to resolve this when no middle ground is there. And again, in the book, I've been able to use all of his correspondence with George Bush to show the way in which this caused a major breakdown in the relationship with the United States. Well, finally, the peace treaty with Israel. I mean, no question that King Hussein saw this as the biggest achievement of his reign, the forging of peace with Israel. What I've been able to do there is, through partly the documents, but also a lot of conversations with someone called Oren Hasona, who deserves special mention. He's now the Vice President of the International Court of Justice in The Hague, but he was the key Jordanian negotiator for the peace treaty. Through him, I've been able to shed new light on what were really the key issues that were at stake here. And actually, it's not the stuff that got into the headlines about border delineation and water. Probably the key issues were, in fact, the question of refugees, and whether reference to the status of refugees should be made in this peace treaty, arbitration, but crucially, the involuntary movement of persons was a big issue. And of course, for those who know the region, what this is all about is the Jordanian fear that at some point in the indeterminate future, Israel might seek to solve the problem of the West Bank Palestinians by one way or another, pressing them out of the West Bank into Jordan. The Jordanians wanted a strong clause that would prohibit this in the treaty. What they got in the end was a watered-down version because the Israelis dug their heels in hard on this one. How are we going to sum King Hussein up in my last minute? I think we can actually go a long way in the terms of President Clinton's remarkable letter of condolence to his successor, his son's successor, King Abdullah. President Clinton actually developed quite a close personal relationship with the king in the last 2 or 3 years of his life. And after his final meeting with the king, which was in Washington, D.C., the new year, into the new year of 1999, based on that meeting, he sent a, it was less than a month before the king died, of course, harking back to that meeting, he sent a letter of condolence to the king's son, the current King Abdullah. And I'll just quote it to finish with, because it's not often that a letter from a politician can bring a tear to your eye, but this one brings a tear to my eye. So this is Clinton. "I had the honour of seeing him just a few weeks before he passed away, as he was about to return home. There was no hint of the extraordinary effort he was undertaking just to stay alive. Instead, he spoke with his customary passion and humanity about his nation's well-being, the future of the Arab world, the fulfillment of the Palestinians' legitimate rights, and peace with Israel. At that moment, I saw once again the depth of his love for his country, his dedication to peace, and his commitment to the universal values of tolerance and mutual respect." Thank you.
That man could certainly turn a phrase.
He could.
Still can, actually. It's a great pleasure for me to comment on what is really a remarkably accomplished book. I've been working with Nigel in the International History Department here at LSE now for 10 years. He's not just a fine colleague, he's also a remarkably accomplished scholar, and I think this book shows that without any doubt, as was your earlier work, Nigel. I'm particularly thinking here about the historian's craft. I mean, I'll come up with some questions that you may want to answer later. There are others here in the audience who know much more about the Middle East than what I do and can ask even more in-depth questions. But I just want to say, to begin with, that it's a long time since I've read a political biography, or indeed a biography of any sort, that has been as well done as history as this one is. And I'm thoroughly impressed with the work that you have done here. I'm impressed with the structure, which is something that is very difficult to do for any biography, but certainly for a biography in which you try to focus on the political life of your subject, but at the same time take the measure of him as a man. And you succeed, I think, remarkably well in doing that. So it's a great pleasure to comment on your book here, Nigel. I want to concentrate my comments, a bit echoing what David has said already, on what drove the king. What were his aims? What were the achievements of his life as measured against those aims? And what we come up with then, as you conclude in your book, is a mixed legacy. It's in many ways a problematic legacy of a man who started his political career when he was very young, far too young, I think many of us would say. Not many teenagers do well in politics. The king certainly struggled from the very beginning in trying to make sense of the area that he was living within, but also of the wider world. And one of the strengths, again, of the book is how well you document his progression on that road. I mean, this is not someone, I think, who was born a very astute politician. I think his emotions were far too strong for that, even measured against others within the region where he was. But someone who was able to focus in on, as his life progressed, as his career progressed, on the issues that were important to him. And these seems to me to be, first and foremost, two directions. There was a dedication to the Hashemite version of Arab unity. And I'll talk more about that in a second. But also a set of pragmatic decisions, a kind of political learning in order to save his country. And that political learning process is one, for those of you who have read the book or will read the book, that comes out remarkably well here. I don't think I've ever read a political life in which that learning process is so pronounced as in the one that you put forward here. The ideals were there from the very beginning, but the learning is connected up to that set of pragmatic decisions that he had to make throughout his life in order to make his country survive. Let me concentrate on three main crises. There are many crises in this book. Indeed, this man goes from one crisis to another throughout his whole career. I mean, you wouldn't have any problem with finding any dramatic material to include in your book at all. But I want to concentrate on three of them. 1967, the war, 1973, Yom Kippur War, and then the Iran-Iraq War, with some comments that is probably that are probably also connected, at least in part, to the first Gulf War. And on the 67 war, and this is something which I'd like you to elaborate a bit further on, beyond what you're saying in the book, and certainly beyond the comments that you had here. And that's in terms of alternatives. Were there alternatives to the path the king chose in 1967? And by alternatives here, I mean alternatives that existed within his dedication to Arab unity of his own sort, and the decisions he had to make in order to save his country. In chapter 7, you open by saying, I don't have the exact quote, but you say that the 67 war was an unmitigated disaster for the king. And clearly it was, both for the king and for his country, in terms of what happened during the war and the after effects of it. Is there, in your view, when you look back at this now, and I know you have some additional materials that are actually not in the book on this, which are very, very important, what kind of alternatives do you foresee? Not as wild speculations as to what he could have done, but within the framework that he actually stood for in terms of alternative actions. I'm thinking about the war itself, but I'm also thinking about its immediate aftermath, which is something that you comment on very briefly. I think it's just one paragraph, really, in the book before you move on to the period between the 67 and 73 wars. Now, on the 1973 war and its aftermath, which is very well covered in the book, you quote, I think it's Dean Brown, when he says that the king played the game beautifully, in terms of staying out of the war, but at the same time being able to achieve something from it. The big question for me with regard to 1973, and again there are people in this room who can comment on this much better and much more in-depth than what I can, is that wasn't it also in terms of Jordan's and the king's influence in the Arab world a very clear setback? I mean, it ended up in a situation post-1973 where Jordan was neither in nor out and was seen very much as marginalized by others who were emerging as powerful actors among the Arabs in a very broad sense, or indeed within the Muslim world as a whole as well, I mean outside the Arab countries. Was this It may have been a beautifully played game, but the hand that he was sitting with at the end of it doesn't strike me as being all that good in terms of what he wanted to achieve later on. Now, you correctly say in the book that he had his eye from the very beginning of that war on what could be achieved later.
Yeah.
Didn't the way he played it, beautiful as it may have been, reduce his chances of actually having an influence on what then would come later on? And then on the Iran-Iraq war especially, but also with regard to the first Gulf War, I'd like you to comment a little bit further, again, there are others here who could comment on this as well, on the King's strategic objectives. Because this seems to me, even after having read your wonderful account of those two conflicts, to be a little bit uncertain, and I'm also a little bit uncertain about exactly where you want to go with it in terms of listing, in terms of setting up very clearly what the King's strategic objectives were, what he wanted to achieve. You argue in the book that he made clear mistakes, and I think, you know, it's obvious, certainly with the Gulf War, but also with particularly the latter phase of the Iran-Iraq War, that many mistakes were made. But what exactly were his strategic mistakes that, you know, contributed to what I was talking about earlier on in terms of Jordan's position within the Arab world, what he had to take into consideration there? And again, it comes back to the issue of options. What other options were actually available? I mean, looking back on history, we may say, you know, Saddam Hussein was a terrible despot. He got his war involved in a war that was a disaster, not just for his country, but for the whole region. Or two wars, in fact. Three, as it ended up being. The last one was certainly his last. But with regard to King Hussein, what kind of options were really available for him, particularly at the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War? Where could, you know, mistakes were made, grantedly, but where else could he have gone in that particular situation, given that he had not been able to do much in terms of influencing positions as they were at the beginning of the war or right before its outbreak? So those are the broad questions that I have with regard to what is a remarkably accomplished biography. And also, I must say, after reading it, not as eloquently stated, I think, anywhere else as in the quote that you have from President Clinton, what was a remarkably accomplished life? I mean, it struck me that King Hussein was a man who, throughout all of this, was able to stay within the realm of his ideals. I mean, that idealism that you pointed out in your comments earlier on tonight as well is something that does come across. Part of that is what may have led him to draw the wrong conclusions in terms of the latter part of what he wanted to do, in terms of the decisions that influenced his country's policies. Jordan survived. He was able to leave it to his son and successor. In that sense, this accomplished life was also a life that left a real legacy, a real accomplishment in terms of Jordan's survival. So in this fine biography, what I'd like to see us develop on in terms of the discussion, where these issues of strategy, where these issues of alternatives, particularly with regard to the major international crisis that he participated in. So it'll be interesting to hear your responses to that later on, Nigel, but I guess we will first open up to you.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was a lot of important comments there, but I think that the thrust of it, we can all agree he had a weak hand. Mm. The question is how well he played that weak hand. I mean, Nigel, would you like to respond on that first?
Yeah, I mean, just briefly on 67, I think the roots of effectively King Hussein's lack of good choices by the end of May 1967 really go back some way. And I think in the book I suggest you really probably could go back arguably to the beginning of the 1960s with the Wasfitol government. And the sort of the king's own personal notion, though, that he should be proactive, that he should be, you know, punching above his weight in Arab politics. And I think his room for manoeuvre in his relationship with Nasser, obviously, is severely constrained, partly as a result of that, by the time you get to May 1967. The other thing that I think I should bring out, maybe just for everybody's benefit, is that King Hussein, and this is just his own view, was always convinced, and absolutely convinced, from November 1966 onwards that the Israelis were coming for the West Bank. And it wasn't going to matter what he did, that they were coming for it one way or another. Now, people I've talked to are never quite sure where he got that conviction from. I've heard suspicions floated that it came in part as a result of his private contacts with Moshe Dayan in particular, that they were coming for whatever he did. That's in his own mind. So in one sense, as I put it in the book, when he gets to decision point at the back end of May 1967, it's not a decision about could he stay out and might he be left alone. It's a question about on what terms is he going to be fighting.
Yes.
And that's why in my view it's less of a mistake, if you're going to call it that, in 67 than it is in 1990 to 91. 1973, it's interesting you come back on that, because I was inclined to swallow Dean Brown's description of this as a brilliantly played hand, and I'll tell you why I was inclined to swallow it, because he came out of it with his relationship with Syria so much enhanced, and Jordanian-Syrian relations become the sort of foundation of his foreign policy through the mid to late 1970s, and he'd accrued an awful lot of credit with the Syrians as a result of what transpires from the documentary record to be the most reluctant and slow-moving flank supporting manoeuvres that one could possibly...
But where the timing is essential.
Yes, and where they're prepared even to give the Israelis the coordinates of Jordanian forces, and the Israeli ambassador in Washington says, well, this is fighting war with all the conveniences, but I've been inclined to essentially to go up that track and say, well, he accrued a lot of credit in Syria. The problem's always the Egyptians, I'm afraid. His view, much like Assad's after the war, becomes the Egyptians were only going to be out for themselves whatever we did, and we might as well just ignore that side of things. But his relationship with Sadat was already extremely poor beforehand. And I think he suspects that there's no future for Jordan in any sort of attempt to build an enhanced relationship with Egypt. So Syria is really his best tack, if you like, in the Arab world. And he does enhance that relationship as a result of what he does in the 73. Where things fall down is the relationship with the United States, you see. And he receives an assurance from Kissinger during the war that you can bank on it that we're going to engage in this peace process after the war on your behalf. And that never happens. And I put it to Kissinger personally when I interviewed him. The Jordanians think he betrayed them. His line was, well, I know they think I betrayed them, but to be honest, I always thought this would be the third one of the disengagements. Well, the third disengagement never came. So maybe you can say he should have been more realistic in terms of his view of American policy, but Kissinger's manoeuvring in this period was obviously difficult for anyone to follow. Now, where we are now? We're on to the Iran-Iraq war. Okay. I think the key thing that everyone seems to miss here is just to talk about his relationship with Saddam Hussein and Iraqi-Jordanian relations is to miss the other element, which is his fears about the revolutionary regime in Tehran. And I try to bring this out a lot in the book. And a lot of it seems very fresh from the perspective of the end of the first decade of the 21st century. He calls the Iranian regime possibly the most inhuman the world has ever produced, which to some people may strike you as a sort of an overstatement. But he warns of an Iranian plan to foster a Sunni-Shia split in the region with Iraq as its first target. Again, it can't seem too remote from our thinking at the end of the first decade of the 21st century. So his fears about the Iranian regime are a big part of the equation. But the other thing, which I hadn't understood again until I went into his files, was the way in which Camp David just causes disaster in the Arab world. In my own mind, I had these naive notions drawn from my teenage years of watching Sadat turn up in Jerusalem and, oh, it's all a good thing, they're making peace, And of course, I'd moved away from that somewhat by working on the region, in an academic way subsequently. But to get into King Hussein's way of thinking, this was a disaster. That's why the chapter is called the Camp David Disaster. It split the Arab world and it fulfilled the goal of three decades of Israeli foreign policy. The 1956 war, the 1967 war, and then Camp David 1978. The problem was always Egypt for Israel. Egypt was the only real strategic threat in the region. Take Egypt out of the equation one way or another, either by destroying it militarily, seizing the opportunity as they do in 67, It's all about taking an opportunity. It's not about any real fear about an Egyptian attack. It's all about taking an opportunity. And then 1978, no coincidence, and Moshe Dayan says, we've got to cut this deal because this takes Egypt out of the equation. So the way in which Camp David divides the Arab world, takes Egypt out of the Arab equation, isolates it and effectively removes any sort of Arab military option, all of this is part of the background to understanding why he makes the choices he does at the start of the Iran-Iraq war.